Vandervale, it's good to see you.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning. Please remember to endorse the sign-up sheets before you exit. I'd appreciate that. And Mr. Smallwood, whenever you're ready, sir. And do you desire to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
Certainly.
May it please the court, I am Lee Smallwood, and I represent Mr. Waters in this case. I was his attorney all the way from the juvenile court through these proceedings. We've raised three issues that we would submit are issues of first impression. I think that the Commonwealth's brief has made it clear that while there's certainly related matters, that these specific matters have not before.
Mr. Smallwood, let me interrupt you and ask you, is your first issue, do we really need to decide that at all? Because that issue relates to whether an appeal was or was not properly noted from juvenile court to circuit court. But I know that your client was charged under one of the offenses spelled out in 16.1269.1C, and the appeal of the transfer only applies to juveniles whose case was transferred pursuant to 269.1A. So, C is the one where basically you're over 14 and you commit a really serious offense, which this one is.
Certainly,
and,
yes.
And as long as the juvenile court finds probable cause and sends the case on to circuit court, that's it. It seems to me. So why do we need to reach your assignment of error given the plain language of the statute?
Well, I think that that's certainly an incisive question, and one, candidly, I
did
not anticipate.
Questions, which is small that.
but what I think that I would say, and this is where it's good that I was with this case from the beginning, is that that statute only provides for essentially a preliminary hearing on appropriate notice given by the Commonwealth. I believe it's 10, it may be 7. It's one of the two days in advance. And the Commonwealth did not provide such a notice in this case on a timely basis. That's why we reverted as the statute provides for.
Well, I'm just looking at, here's the language I'm concerned about. 269.4 says, if the juvenile court transfers the case pursuant to subsection A of 269.1, the juvenile may, within 10 days after the juvenile court's final decision, file a notice of appeal of the decision to the appropriate circuit court. That's the provision you're relying on. My question is, does that even apply when a transfer occurred pursuant to C, not A?
Well, but a transfer didn't occur pursuant to C. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
This was a transfer pursuant to subsection A of 269.1 because the Commonwealth didn't give the requisite notice as required by the statute, and the statute provides for in those cases that would be covered under C, for a Section A transfer to be had not on advance notice, but on any notice to the juvenile court that the Commonwealth desires a transfer, and that's what we had here. We had a Section A transfer proceeding, and that's why an appeal was noted pursuant to a 269.1 subsection A transfer decision that the judge made, not just simply a notice and preliminary hearing under.
I guess the next question would be, why was there a transfer proceeding under A when it wasn't necessary?
It's because the Commonwealth, there's a notice provision in 269.1C, and the Commonwealth blew that notice provision. They didn't give notice in a timely manner.
I understand that, but that doesn't explain to me why then suddenly A does apply when it ordinarily wouldn't.
That's my recollection, not having that statute in front of me, exactly what the statute provides for, that if there is no transfer pursuant to C, then there is a transfer hearing pursuant to A.
Okay. I'll take your word for that.
Right, and that's my recollection there of exactly how we did. I know that we had a subsection A transfer hearing, and that's why there was an appeal pursuant to 269.4.
Of your argument then, here I guess everybody assumed the juvenile court clerk was going to handle the notice of appeal for you, but And I gather you point out a supposed conflict between the statute and the rule. Wouldn't the statute trump the rule if there is a conflict?
I don't think that in this case, thinking about the statute and doing this from memory without it also in front of me.
Because the statute clearly puts the burden on the appellant to file their notice of, quote, file their notice of appeal to the circuit court.
I think that what I would say, given that, assuming without conceding that you're correct about what the statute says, then, yes, I think the order of things is a statute does have superior power over a rule. Our conception of this, however, has been this is a situation where there are two rules that are contradictory or at least somewhat contradictory or can be read contradictory. A circuit court has, in its reasoning, applied Rule 3A19B. We would submit that in spite of what the Commonwealth asserts in its brief, because this was a transfer proceeding, that's all the more reason that a Rule 8:20 rule would not apply, because, as the Commonwealth indicated, that is a rule that would apply to juveniles, and the 3A19B rule would not apply to juveniles, according to, I think it's Rule 3A1. But this is a transfer. That's the whole issue that's at play here, is adulthood. We would argue that Mr. Waters would be sufficiently an adult at the point that a transfer decision has been made by the judge, and it's being sent to the circuit court, and so that's why Rule 3A19B would be the appropriate rule. I think that I would say in terms of the second issue that we have on appeal, that being the issue of the order authorizing the Commonwealth to seek an indictment, that in large part that may mostly live and die based upon the outcome of the first assignment of error, but I think that there is a small sliver of hope there, and that is that in making the findings that the court made, the court indicated that it was ruling that there was no perfected appeal, but it put the Commonwealth on notice that it was entering an order enabling them to seek an indictment, and that would be the reason that we would submit that we're beyond the opinion of then Attorney General, now Justice Mims, that considered whether such an order was needed. It may be that in general cases an order is needed. I mean, it is not needed, but we would submit that in the posture that the circuit court put itself in, that an indictment would need to be something that was sought after that point. Moving on to the third assignment of error before my rebuttal time, it's the only one that doesn't have something to do with the appeal itself. We would submit that the circuit court clearly, and we believe the appendix that has been prepared, although it does not contain the order that's not related directly to this case from the April, I forget the exact day, the prior meeting of the grand jury in question. The hearing itself has enough uncontested facts in it in terms of what that order contains that this issue is preserved. We would submit that the circuit court clearly dismissed those grand jurors. Certainly it made
Didn't the circuit court explain in the record that it basically said, when I said you're dismissed, I meant you're basically done for the day? I recall that from the record somewhere. And in any event, grand jurors are summoned. I understand your position that they can only serve once during a specified period of time, but they serve for an entire term of court. And in some jurisdictions, a term of court might be 30 days, as it is in my where I live, or it might be 60 or 90 days in more rural areas. So, do we not take judicial notice of the fact that grand jurors serve for an entire term of court, whatever that may be in a particular jurisdiction?
I think certainly that is the practice. I think the problem here is that the circuit court, while it's free to interpret its words to a certain extent, used what I would suggest is kind of akin to a magic word from the statute and indicated in its order that these grand jurors were discharged.
So every single indictment they returned after that point is null and void?
I think that it's at least voidable. I think the question of whether they are null and void or voidable is one that is resolved. It didn't come up in my research for this case, but I've had another case that I've argued to this court in a merit. And I believe there is a statute that actually would tend to suggest it is only voidable and that the issue has to be raised before the trial.
They were without any authority to act as a grand jury from that moment on.
Yes, in light of the fact that once there is a discharge, then new grand jurors must be called until all grand jurors have been called. That's essentially a summary of the three issues that exist, unless there are any questions before my esteemed colleague in the Attorney General's office argues, then I will reserve my remaining
time.
Thank
you, Smalley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Chris Chandevel for the Commonwealth. In this appeal, Mr. Waters argues that various alleged deficiencies in the proceedings leading up to the indictments entitle him to a reversal of his convictions and the dismissal of those indictments. Mr. Waters is incorrect that there were any deficiencies leading up to those indictments, and even if he were correct, at least on the second two assignments of error, he's not shown he was prejudiced by any alleged indictments, and thus he is not entitled to any relief. I'll start with the first assignment of error and respond to a question from Your Honor. I do think that if he had been transferred under subsection C, obviously, then the assignment of error would be moot in this appeal. However, I do think that, as Mr. Smallwood has argued today, because there was no notice provided, subsection C could not be used. Additionally, if you look at page 1 of the appendix, the transfer retention order, there is a line and a check mark beside the line that says the factors in subsection A were considered in that transfer decision. So I do believe that he was transferred under subsection A. As a result, the question of the notice of appeal is a valid question for this court. However, that question really is an easy question. Under Code Section 16.1-269.4, the notice of appeal has to be filed. The word filed has a very plain and obvious meaning. Elsewhere in the code, it's interpreted as being delivered in the clerk's office. Rule 8:20 of the Supreme Court of Virginia provides some further clarification. That rule says, in all notices of appeal, the appeal has to be noted in writing, and it has to be it's properly noted when it's timely filed in the clerk's office. Here, neither of those things were done. It wasn't done in writing, and it wasn't timely filed in the clerk's office.
Is there a conflict in the two Supreme Court rules?
There's not, Your Honor. And the reason why there's no conflict, as Mr. Smallwood, I think, has at least partially conceded today, is that Part 3A of the rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia do not apply to proceedings involving juveniles in the JNDR court. Rule 3A:1 states that it does not apply to such proceedings involving juveniles in the JNDR court. And because of that, Rule 8:20 controls, and Rule 8:20 is really quite clear as to what has to be done. You can see the fact that in addition to Rule 3A:1 stating it doesn't apply, Rule 3A:19, which he relies on, states that it only applies to appeals of convictions. Mr. Waters was not convicted in the JNDR court. It was simply a transfer decision. And the fact that 3A:19 uses the word conviction and does not use the phrase adjudicated delinquent is further evidence that Part 3A of the rules does not apply to cases in JNDR court involving juveniles. It just further drives home that point. So for that reason, the first assignment of error, the trial court did not err in finding that there was no valid appeal of the transfer decision. As to the second assignment of error, the argument is that the trial court erred by not quashing the indictments because the Commonwealth obtained indictments after the trial court had authorized the Commonwealth to do so, but before the trial court had entered an order authorizing the Commonwealth to do so. That assignment of error is without merit for the simple reason that in this case, there was no appeal of that transfer decision. As a result of there being no appeal, the Commonwealth was not required to wait for the trial court to enter an order enabling it to obtain indictments before obtaining those indictments. And that opinion was clearly expressed by then-Attorney General Bill Mims in 2009, an Attorney General opinion that he issued in response to a question from the trial judge. That question was raised after the General Assembly amended the statute in 1996.
The Attorney General opinions carry more weight with the court when the author goes on to become a Justice of the Supreme Court.
I do not know if that is a black letter principle of law, although if it is, we would certainly rely on it in this case. However, while it's true that Attorney General opinions normally are simply persuasive authority on Virginia's appellate courts, the rule is different when the Attorney General is expressing an opinion as to statutory construction, and the General Assembly does not thereafter go in and amend the statute to change in response to the Attorney General's position. I think I cited seven cases on brief from the Supreme Court of Virginia and published opinions from this court stating that when the Attorney General issues a formal opinion expressing his or her interpretation of a statute and the General Assembly thereafter does not change that statute, then the General Assembly is understood to have acquiesced in the Attorney General's interpretation of that statute. Since 2009, that Attorney General opinion was issued, the statute has been amended only one time. I think on brief I said it had been amended one time since 1996, but what I meant to say is that it had been amended one time since 2009, that AG opinion. And that amendment did nothing to change this particular part of the statute, and for that reason, Virginia courts have held, and this court should hold, the General Assembly is understood to have acquiesced in the Attorney General's opinion that there is no requirement that the Commonwealth wait for an enabling order before obtaining indictments in cases where there is no appeal of that transfer decision. So that is really controlling as to the second assignment of error. It also helps avoid what would be a meaningless result after the change to the law in 1996. Before 1996, circuit courts were required in every case where there was a transfer to review those J&DR court records and determine whether or not the proper procedures had been followed, regardless of whether there was an actual appeal of that decision. With that change in 1996, the circuit court is only required to do that sort of a review of the record in cases where there is an appeal of that transfer decision. So it follows naturally that the Commonwealth shouldn't have to wait for an enabling order if there's nothing for the circuit court to review because there's been no appeal of the transfer decision. So interpreting the statute in the way the Attorney General Mims did avoids what would otherwise be a meaningless result from the interpretation that Mr. Waters suggests. Additionally, not only is the second assignment of error without merit, he would also have to show that he was prejudiced by the Commonwealth obtaining indictments before that enabling order was entered in order to obtain relief. That's the Jamborski case, which I cited on brief. Obviously, he has not shown that he was prejudiced in any way. The Commonwealth could have obtained new indictments if the circuit court had required, and we'd be in the same place now that we otherwise would have been. As to the third assignment of error, the argument that there was an error in failing to quash the indictments because the grand jurors were summoned twice. A trial court is allowed to interpret its own orders. In this case, the circuit court interpreted its order to mean when I said discharge, I just meant you're allowed to go home for the day. But the trial court told the grand jurors, you're the grand jurors for the entire term. And certainly a term that lasts multiple months is permissible. The Supreme Court of Virginia said that in the Mohammed case, which I cited on brief. Additionally, it's especially important to allow circuit courts to interpret their orders in a case like this, where the order itself apparently never made it into the record that's before this court, which of course is the appellant's burden. So we don't have that record to look at to make our own assessment. So all the more reason for this court to defer to the trial court's interpretation of its own orders. Finally, of course, he also would be required to show prejudice, even assuming he could show that there was error. And there was no prejudice to Mr. Waters from the fact that some of the grand jurors, even assuming they were inconvenienced more than they should have been under the statute, he certainly was not prejudiced, so he's not entitled to any relief. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. No, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smallwood, you have about 4 minutes remaining for rebuttal, if you desire to use it, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that in all candor, the issues here are well presented. I appreciate the work that the Commonwealth has done in terms of this. I think that I've had a full opportunity to say the things that I would say. I appreciate the argument of Mr. Sandoval. And unless there are other questions, I think that I am happy to release the remainder of my time as well.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Smallwood. We'll come down and greet counsel.